Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your host for this evening's program. We welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's program and our speakers. Digital marketing is constantly evolving with incredible advancements in technology, partnerships, acquisitions, and new strategic thinking. Ad blocking, artificial intelligence, programmatic media buying, and big data are constant buzzwords we hear about in the marketing landscape. We have an outstanding panel of industry experts who will bring us all up to date and share their thinking. A special thanks to the people at Cred PR. And now, our moderator, Anika Gupta, will lead the program. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us today. Before we get started, I wanted to get a quick show of hands. How many of you would consider yourself experts in digital marketing? Okay, a couple hands, not too many. How many of you are familiar with but do not consider yourself experts? Okay. And any people that are real beginners who know the concept but don't know very much about our industry? Okay, a couple there too. Great. Well, we have a really exciting panel here today. Our panelists have a range of backgrounds, so you're going to hear about where digital marketing is going from the agency perspective, from the platform perspective, from a publisher perspective, and from the advertiser perspective. So to get started, I'd like each of our panelists to give a quick intro about themselves. Do you want to start, Ming?
Sure. Very nice to be here with all of you. I've lived in the Bay Area for 20 years. I think it is very exciting place and time to be in digital marketing. My experience is really twofold. I've been on the publisher side. I spent 5 years in the mid-2000s at Yahoo overseeing the non-search monetization. I spent 4 years on the agency and advertiser side at Omnicom, running the programmatic agency called Acuen, and really starting that, been fortunate enough to start that with a bunch of our industry colleagues, the idea of programmatic marketing. I spent last year as the executive vice president of marketing at SolarCity before Tesla bought the company, and now I'm chief revenue officer at Mighty Hive, which is a programmatic as a service company.
Great. Mason Garrity. I've spent most of my digital marketing experience working with startups. So the last 7 years on the agency side, last five as the vice president of strategy at 3Q Digital. back in 2006, I started in paid search at kayak.com when it was about a 40-person company, only really eight on the business side. So really got to see how companies could grow using digital marketing, and that's really how I got hooked on that. 3Q Digital, we're really based out of Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and we pride ourselves on the growth we've achieved for some of the name-brand startups around this area, companies like Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pandora, using kind of a full suite of digital marketing from the media side to technology and tools, customer research, analytics, et cetera. So full spectrum of what you can do within digital marketing. And thanks, everyone, for being here. Really happy to be a part of this, and should be a good evening.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me here. Nikesh Desai. I am glad to be back in the Bay Area where I grew up, but live in New York. My background, spent about 20 years in digital media, internet services, financial services, spent a few years out of college at Robertson Stephens, an investment bank in the Bay Area, where I was doing a lot of technology, M&A, internet, corporate finance, jumped ship to try my hand at a startup that saw them through their VC round, IPO and eventual acquisition, and ISP and ad-based model called People PC, and decided to move to New York. Thought I'd be there for a couple of years. It's been 14 now. And ran BizDev at thestreet.com, which combined my background in financial services and internet media. Started a revenue strategies business called Giant Step Strategies, where I was helping primarily financial media and other online media companies with their revenue strategies. How do you balance an ad business with a subscription business? How do you drive traffic? How do you train your sales team? How do you manage and optimize ad campaigns all digitally, and that morphed into Investing Channel about 9 years ago, this month actually. And we're about 40 folks. I'm co-founder, CEO, and we're a financial marketing platform. So we basically help niche retail to institutional digital audiences and sites target their content and leveraging our data and tech to pinpoint really finite audiences for major brand marketers like BlackRock, State Street, Fidelity, Schwab, TTA, et cetera. So excited to be here.
Great. So to kick it off, I wanted to start out by talking about the consumer, because if you think about digital advertising and marketing in general, it all comes back to trying to influence the behavior of an actual person. So I want to ask the panel, what are some trends you've been seeing over the past 5, 10, or 20 years around how content is actually being consumed by people?
I'll start. This is really... I think just from at least me as a consumer thinking about it coming out of college in the mid-90s, it was about kind of mainstream... offline companies coming online, or either new online companies like iVillage or others that had mass investments, mass appeal. And I think over, the last 10, 15 years, it's moved into, of course, social, but with WordPress and things of that nature, it became so much easier for any one of us to write content. And as I look at just why I even started my business, the shift of consumers went from a Yahoo Finance or Journal or Street.com to, really niche environments to get in what my business is, investing content, and a lot more engaged audiences, I think, dispersed into smaller, more niche in environments. So I've seen at least over the last 20 years a pretty big shift, not necessarily away from mainstream media, but towards niche media, but also media driven by data, not just kind of journalistic editorial, which is still important, but folks like Vox or BuzzFeed and others, where it's much a big part of either the content itself is driven by data, or at least the strategy for content distribution.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has really changed this context of content consumption, if you look back 10, 20 years, very predictable, print media, TV, you kind of knew where the people were when they were consuming the content. Now, obviously, with smartphones being ubiquitous, you don't necessarily know how people are consuming content and why. That's a very difficult thing that I think a lot of people on the advertising side are struggling with, because of the mobility and, the ability to just check in and read something when you have 5 minutes. You don't necessarily know the frame of mind that someone's in, where they may be going, where they may be coming from. And that kind of leads into all of the data that's out there. But the context of content consumption has really changed from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah, I think if you go back 50 years, when there were just three channels plus PBS in the 60s and 70s, what's happened since then is this massive fragmentation. It's benefited agencies. Agencies thrive on being the experts at navigating that fragmentation and diversity of choices. But it's harder than ever to find the consumer in context at the right time, at the right place with the right message. And I'd say if you go from the three-channel system to cable TV to the digital era, and then you have the programmatic era over the last 5 years, the one thing that's starting to take shape is that technology now exists to wrangle and wrestle and control all of that fragmentation. We're getting there in a much better way. We're not going to ever get back to three channels. Maybe Google and Facebook and Amazon would like that. But we're starting now through the use of technology to be able to control and reach certain audiences and know that reach and frequency as a marketer. It's still very hard because new things come up like Snapchat or Messenger bots, artificial reality, virtual reality, augmented reality. Those are all in the future and in today, but I think there's no more exciting time because that technology has given back the control to the marketer.
So, Ming, you mentioned technologies emerging to wrangle all of these different channels and other technologies and ways to reach consumers. How is that technology actually working? How is that impacting digital marketing today and how advertisers are thinking about reaching out and interacting with consumers?
Yeah, so if you go back to the days of digital, when I was at Yahoo, there were three major publishers you could buy: Yahoo, AOL, and MSN.
That's right.
And that was it. You covered most of America, and you could buy Yahoo Sports and AOL Sports, MSN Money, something like that. But you couldn't control the frequency by which those people took your media dollars and distributed it. Just like it's very hard to control that in TV. We've all seen the same commercial too many times because we happen to watch certain shows over and over again or a certain type of show. That is media waste because I don't need to see that ad. I don't need to see that ad 30 times in, let's say, on Saturday. It's just too much. In digital, when you have three or four partners, they get to control the frequency, but you can't control it. You can only tell them what to do, three a day. It used to be the, I think still today, a very, very good way to go. But what you really want to do is say, I only want to reach this person three a day across all my buys, across Google, Facebook, Twitter, and in the video format, mobile format. You want to say, is that three? Is it 10 times a month? Is it 25 times a month? There are technologies now. There are many platforms, decisioning engines. The Trade Desk has gone public. It's a fantastic IPO for them over the last 12 months. Google is a dominant player in this industry and has been for many, many years. So I'm accustomed to using technologies like that. Amazon has come out with theirs. Yahoo has. There are a number of different companies where you can have a layer on top of all your publisher buys and say, I've seen that user enough times. I don't want to show them another ad. So those are decisioning engines that now are able to control them. And I think when you marry that with data, then it's amazing. You can go by psychographic, demographic, interests, behavior with the combination of publisher context. And you really have a much better marketing system than we did 10 and 5 years ago.
So the kind of the ubiquity of smartphones has allowed advertisers to be more interactive with consumers. So how have we seen creative change from the days you talked about frequency capping, but how has creative actually changed since TV advertising was really the main, when print advertising was really the main way to reach consumers?
Yeah, well, you see video being a lot more popular now, and not just, you know, within in-app advertising, but within Facebook's stream. That's one of the more popular and successful formats that we've seen work. Video, it used to just be kind of pre-roll YouTube, pre-roll premium content, the wait for 5 seconds to skip this. But with people kind of in that scroll mentality, they'll stop and they'll watch ads on Facebook if your content is strong enough and, you know, you have a captive audience because they are making the choice to watch that. Beyond that, there are some really cool formats that, have been around for the last year or two, like, 360 ads where you can create an immersive environment and, you know, the user can scan their phone around and see a 360 degree ad. You know, that'll feed into what happens when AR and VR become more prominent platforms. How does advertising get integrated into those? You know, the content has to be on par. The formats have to live up to the platform standards. I think we're seeing a lot more of that with video as it relates to Facebook. But, you know, when you start talking about AR and VR, the content there is much more complicated, much more cost intensive. So that's going to be a challenge.
With all of this innovation and technology and access to data, has drastically improved. So advertisers now have more access to different types of data that they've never had access to before. So how are advertisers and technology platforms and publishers actually leveraging this data to improve their marketing?
I'll jump in here. Just speaking from what we do and anecdotally what others, you know, marketing hasn't changed fundamentally. You're still looking for your audience. It's just with the internet and with the combination of how much data is available now, you're actually able to pinpoint audiences where in the past you were using context, really, you know, what people were reading or what they were watching or what they were listening to figure out who they are. Now there's a ton of off and online data that can really tell you who it is. Just as an example of that, I can target in our network someone who manages $1 billion, trades ETFs in the Northeast by taking FINRA and SEC offline filings as an example, coupling that with some online data, matching it to LiveRamp, and then pushing it through ad exchanges, right? And that was just non-existent before at such finite levels. So data has completely changed how you can really pinpoint audiences. I was talking to someone else the other day who's in real estate, and they said they were trying to sell a $20 million Manhattan apartment, and they used social profiling to figure out who their audience is and sold that apartment within 2 weeks. Because they got a lead off of it. I mean, it's just things like that. It was just not possible before, and what data is allowing marketers to do at you know, from mom and pop folks to major brands as well.
Yeah, I think really what that's one of our goals as an agency, just to be able to tie together all these disparate pieces of data, understanding how they're interacting with the site or product or app, what their business value is, all the first party data that's available, and marrying that with the psychographic, demographic, consumer profile attributes that we can pull in from third party data partners. And I think the other piece that can often be forgotten is the qualitative, the trying to understand the consumer mindset, the motivations, how they measure success, what they're trying to accomplish with a product. That is a data point as well. And it really can be the most powerful when you can speak to that customer on the emotional level and really start understanding their journey and how you can best meet that and tie in those other data sources to support it.
Yeah, I think just along those lines, one thing I didn't mention is it's one thing to find your audience, but you know, what's the intent of that audience, yeah, right, is a bit of what you're talking about. And I think that's what is another phase that is there. I mean, we have auto intender data points. Sometimes you got to question the quality of the data, but we're spending a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, what is the intent of, again, in my vertical, of this financial audience. Are they going to trade? Are they going to open up an account? Are they going to, do they want an advisor? And that doesn't exist too much in context. So what's the journey that, you know, you're able to figure out that pinpoints, you know, what that intent is? And some of the at least right now, what I call basic things that we're doing is just putting conversion pixels on a confirmation page. When someone goes through a process and says, all right, I want to open up a brokerage account, that's a trigger. And we look back at the history of what that person did. You know, what clickstream did they go through to actually decide to convert at that point? And those are just some examples of how we're trying to figure out not just who that person is, that hedge fund manager who manages $1 billion, but what their intent may be down the line.
Yeah, I would say that there is a ton of data. There's more data. Some of the data that's out there is scary. When you understand what somebody checked out of a store with on their credit card, and you can get down to the brand, oh, you bought Snyder's of Hanover's pretzels, and you also bought some a beer or something. You're in diapers. Maybe you're a dad. You know, the consumers don't. We're going to talk about privacy later, but you could say that there's too much data. And for us and me during this span, it's always been about what you do with that data. But you can save yourself a ton of money. You can make your dollar. You can stretch your dollar 2x, 3x sometimes by using that data. And that's exciting to everybody in marketing and in sales. So I don't think I'll ever get away from automotive. It just seems to be a part of my career. One of the pieces of work we did was an automaker wanted to completely revamp their brand. And they started with the new flagship vehicle. Their brand was something that stood for a something that they wanted to move away from and define it much better. So they came up with a target persona. They told us that these are folks who are young and trendy, live in urban areas, are young, active, like to hike on the weekends. This SUV is going to be the best product for them. It's not that expensive, but it has all the luxury features. And so we did our job as a good team, and we went out and targeted those people. But to your point, if you track the people that interacted with the ad and interacted with the site, we did get all those single, exciting young people. But the people who scheduled a test drive and wanted a dealer to contact them were actually families from the Midwest in rural areas that they didn't expect at all. So you could know that. We knew that within 30 to 60 days of starting to run their brand new campaign. They had billboards everywhere. They had television ads. They were doing digital, Facebook, video. And for us to go back and say, this is working, but the people who actually buy your cars look like this, you can get the creative agency, the marketing folks at the car company to start thinking differently that quickly. I think something like that would have taken a year for them to figure out in the old days. So the data, if we had spent our time analyzing the terabytes of data that are out there, we would have missed that. But you just have to think like a marketer, act like a marketer, and look for that clear signal.
Yeah, I think that's a great example and why you need to be careful when you start talking about target personas, because typically they're used for, you know, creative briefs or something the company can rally around. But in reality, you need to rely on the data that's coming in and tweak those very quickly, because the data will tell the truth and allow you to be much more effective with your spend.
And the number of cars sold by that company nearly doubled in the next 4 years. So it's just an amazing thing that they could do.
Well, Ming, since you brought up privacy, let's jump in and talk about that. Since whenever you think about data, privacy becomes a big question. So for all of you, we're all consumers here. As a consumer, how do you feel about how data is being used and the privacy controls around that? Are the controls available today enough? Does something need to change? Do you think that's actually going to those changes are actually going to happen?
It's way too hidden. There was just a law passed the other day where ISPs now can sell the data, right? It was Obama said no, Trump said yes. And I don't think there's going to be any change in the next few years on giving back some control to the end consumer. But I think at least it creates maybe a little bit more competition against Google and Facebook, who owns the majority of the data. I just think it's privacy advocates have an uphill battle, and I would like to think or hope that, you know, users would have a lot more clarity on what the use of that data is. We were just joking earlier, we were saying, look, when you go through your iPhone and they have that upgrade and you have to click on the terms of service, you just want to use your phone. You're not reading through all that. You can't redline that agreement and send it back to their lawyer. It's just, right now the privacy is in the hands of, you know, big business, not in on the consumer side.
Yeah, I think people would be a lot more comfortable with sharing their personal information if marketers did a better job of utilizing it. There's so much data out there, and there are a lot of tools that can tie it together, but the reality is not many people are doing it well. Digital marketing gets a really bad rap because of all the bad actors and the people doing it poorly. That's why you see ad blockers on the rise. Salesforce just reported that 64% of millennials are willing to give up personal information if it helps with personalized recommendations, and 58% of Gen Xers. People are willing to give up information if you're going to use it to enhance the product and enhance the value you get out of something. But the reality is you get peppered with terrible ads. You get hit, 30 times with something you're never going to buy just because you looked at a site. So really, I think, as digital marketers, everyone needs to get a lot better with how they use all this data. Otherwise, people are going to be pushing back on privacy and what they share, because it's not really enhancing the experience. It's not adding value. to the experience at all.
I'm just prepared to live in a world with no privacy. I think the ship has sailed on that. If you're on the internet, I mean, it's all out there. So I do agree that it's up to us as the marketing industry to do a better job so that it's not a problem. But you see the revolt because it has we haven't yet delivered on that promise.
And I think it's a great segue. Like, what is it going to take to actually deliver on that promise? What has to change in the industry and who has to make those changes?
Well, on the flip side, I think many people are extremely happy with it, right? So anybody who opts in and uses Facebook, your option is to not use it. If you, you're going to do searches, most people use Google, and they have every single search I've ever done. It's interesting, the legislation about the ISPs, I think the Obama proposal was to not allow them to sell it. But this entire time, they've been allowed to sell it. His group said, well, we'd like to put in legislation that says they shouldn't sell it. So it's interesting that they haven't violated that piece of consumer privacy to date. And Trump did say he's taken that away. But will people like that continue to respect our browsing patterns? I don't know. Certainly, people-based marketing from Facebook, they know who we are on every single device. That's a very important piece of value. As long as they keep providing value, maybe a show of hands, who's ready to unplug their Facebook account? You know.
I got two hands.
Right. So there you have it. That's why I say I think it's done.
Great. So you talked a little bit about Facebook. It's hard to talk about digital marketing without talking about both Google and Facebook, who are receiving increasing advertiser dollars and increasing market share. I wanted to ask the panel, what do you think is going to happen? Is everything going to consolidate to Google and Facebook? Is there going to be a revolt against Google and Facebook from the rest of the ecosystem? And what's going to happen? Predict the future. Well, that's what we're here to do.
That's my day-to-day business. So I would say I think there is a significant consolidation because of that. And we have become, over the last 4 years, experts at the entire Google stack, extremely tight partners with them. And we were getting so many inbound requests from advertisers, marketers, you name it, to come talk to them, consult, execute, do technology systems integration so that they can get the best out of the Google system. And I think the same is true for Facebook. We're doing that as well and helping them tie their Facebook and Google together. There are other platforms out there. I mentioned the consolidation. That's the trend their marketers are latching onto now. They want to control this marketing dollar. And when they can do that, they get more out of it. They save money. So from my standpoint, I see it continuing. There will be other players, and I'm looking forward to that. But for now, those two are extremely powerful.
Yeah, I think with kind of our existing channel options, they will consolidate. You look at the mobile ad space, that's one of the more fragmented spaces right now. You know, search is pretty much owned. Social platforms, pretty much owned, even though there are some other players. Mobile display, extremely fragmented. And while that space is going through consolidation and condensing a bit, Google and Facebook are just passing all the small players. They can't really compete at that level where we look at Google and Facebook as the first places where we're going to put mobile dollars because of that, because of their reach and the tools they have. Not to mention, when you talk about a fragmented space, there's a lot of overhead that goes into managing that. Not knowing whether or not certain networks will have scale, whether they can meet your efficiency goals. Google and Facebook, you know what you're getting. But to then test 10 mobile display partners, there's just a lot of management overhead that goes into that. I think as we talk about platforms, marketing platforms of the future, different formats of advertising, that'll definitely open the door for new entrants. But at the same time, look at some of the technologies we've already hit on. Google and Facebook are pretty well positioned to own those as well. Smart home, VR, AR, they're kind of already leading in those spaces. So I think they're positioned well to kind of be the leading advertising platform in those spaces as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to disagree, but you know, I can't. I mean, they're going to be dominant players. They're going to eat up most of the ad budgets. If you own the data, you own the user. But I think it behooves the leftovers, 10, 15, 20% of the ad market, and those publishers, those providers, to create value, to engage users in different ways, to make sure they can own as much of that, you know, consumer, customer, and data as much as possible. But I agree that consolidation is somewhat inevitable, and it benefits the marketer in a lot of ways. But, you know, I live in a somewhat different world in the finance and investing world. I don't know if I see them encroaching as much, even though they're there considerably. But it's hard to kind of, I think, beat that those two when people are willing to give them data, and that's a big benefit that they both have.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Does it benefit you? Do you benefit from the system through monetization without the headcount that used to be required, and through overlays of data, you could monetize your users and your traffic at a higher rate? Do you see that happening?
Well, I'm speaking from the publisher point of view, right? And I think it benefits us as we bring our first-party data into their platforms. So we're finding our audience much more easily with scale. And so in that sense, it does benefit us. But the flip side of it is they're still taking a lot of that dollar back. And what they do with our data that we bring to the table is also problematic. So in the end, it's tough. Yes, it does benefit us. But I think the long-term publishers have a huge uphill battle to continue to grow their ad revenue stream, and why FT, for example, is pouring a ton of dollars into their subscription business now. Because the ad business is just difficult given what they're competing against. So yeah, it benefits, I think, in the short term. Long term, I think it's difficult for publishers.
So it sounds like the consensus is towards consolidation. So I wanted to ask a follow-up. What do you think is going to happen with Amazon, who is another big player in the space, but not exactly sure how many advertising dollars are going to go there, and emerging players like Snapchat?
Lots of money for Amazon.
Yeah.
I'm unwilling to give up my account, so they know everything that I've bought for the last 10 years. Yeah. I can look up on what day that surge protector broke and call them up and get another one. It's amazing. So they're offering a key piece of this puzzle, which is the behavior. Facebook knows who you are, but Amazon knows what you buy. And that, wow. I mean,
that's ultimate.
It's not a surprise that they are taking off, which is why we're being... it's very exciting to be able to close the loop and understand what top of the funnel, mid funnel, bottom funnel advertising actually drives the actual purchase, or even putting it in your shopping cart and not finishing that purchase.
Yeah, I think Amazon's very well positioned. And if you look at their revenue stream from advertising, it's been growing significantly. And they haven't even made a major push into it yet. When you think about all that data that they have access to, there are tons of ad formats they can get into. When we look at voice searches making up about 25% of searches, okay, well, there's Google Home and there's Alexa right now as kind of the two main players for in-house voice assistants. So they have that piece. They're one of the, I think, companies that can challenge Google in the search domain, Google Shopping Ads. Amazon has that ability to do that because 50% of commercial searches are taking place on Amazon, and they're not putting nearly as much effort into it as Google is. So they are positioned pretty well for that.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, they've got the ultimate intent, knowing what people are buying. I don't admit to knowing Snapchat as well. I still don't quite get it. I wonder if it'll be sustainable. There's an article today saying Disney may buy them because their longevity is, you know, again, questionable. Facebook's building a lot of those kind of tools and elements into their system. But I'm a believer in Amazon, maybe less so Snapchat.
Yeah, I'd say less so with Snapchat, just because they've been copied already.
Yeah.
You know, they're right now where Facebook was when they IPO'd, trying to figure out how to monetize. And Facebook had a much bigger user base. They just needed 1 in 10 ad products to work, and they had a $1 billion revenue stream. Snap doesn't have that as many users, and it was already surpassed by Instagram Stories, which is a much more developed you know, advertising platform. And now you can advertise on Instagram Stories. So in a way, they've been caught up to and maybe surpassed. So I think they're going to have a tough road.
So one of the challenges that advertisers have with Google and Facebook and Amazon too, to whatever extent they're advertising on Amazon, is that these are closed gardens and they're not able to get data back out of these systems. Do you think that that's going to change over time, or do you think that Google and Facebook are kind of going to remain closed to the advertiser?
Well, I think that's their asset. They have amazing data, and they're using it. But they're also open in the sense that you can go onto at least the Google platform and buy almost any piece of media if it's connected to Google, and you can connect that. We help people do that all the time. Once it's connected, you can execute the buy using Google's data and other people's data in combination. But you can buy off of the Google network. You're not stuck just buying from AdX or the Google Display Network. You can certainly buy. You know, I'd love to connect your website to some of our clients and execute that over the Google platform. It would, you know, we do that all the time.
What about from a measurement perspective? Measurement analytics?
That's more on, I think, the company. You can use that data pretty well. You can understand what traffic sources people are coming from. So even if they're coming from Google, you know, we can still use technology on the back end to help identify the characteristics around them, to, you know, see where else we have reached them with ads outside of Google. With the right technology in place, you know, you can kind of unlock some of that walled garden aspect that they have, you know, and get a lot more data, I think, on the user level.
Yeah, they are walled gardens, but I feel like they're pretty open still for us to leverage, I mean, not all, but a good amount of their data. And I think that will become more transparent. And for us as a publisher to bring data into that environment, I think there are other systems, like LinkedIn, I feel like is much more of a walled garden. They really, you know, keep it to themselves, and it's a great, I love their business, but I actually feel like Google and Facebook are going to get even more available from a walled garden point of view.
Great. So it's come up a couple times on the panel, just the complexity of navigating technology and data that marketers have access to. How is this complexity and all this innovation changing the role of marketing in organizations and the CMO?
I'll try. So a long time ago, I think we let people do things full service. We would hire, and I think there's always going to be a role for agencies. It's going to be for the marketers who want to have more control, more direct precision, hands on keyboard, for example. What exists today, there are self-service tools now. And so we used to all call a broker to place a stock trade. We don't do that anymore. We used to have an insurance agent, Farmers or State Farm. There was a person, you had an agent. Now when you go to Progressive or Esurance, you don't have a intermediary. You are personally logging in and handling that transaction. So I do think that same exact trend is happening in marketing, where people are getting really smart. They want to have more control. They see the results, and they want to do that directly. Is it easy? Not necessarily. We help and train people to do that. We'll do it for them for a little while. But there's a continuum, I think, of solutions out there in the service model. That's the biggest change that I've seen. In the beginning of the programmatic days, people were happy to just let you do it. And then they got smart and they said, well, what if I did it? Then I might not need you anymore. I was there during the heyday of that. And it, you know, at some point it became less about the work and about the payment model to the agency. So I think that's come under pressure. That's been played out. Transparency of fees is really has really taken heart. But I think for a lot of advertisers, for whatever reason, they don't need to have that. They're happy with the performance. They want the full service. There's a lot to manage. If you want to take it in-house, it takes a certain kind of company and team to want to do that. I don't think that I would be in marketing if it was a different time. You know, I have an engineering background. We hired people from hedge funds, from MIT, from Berkeley, from Stanford. The traditional media agency doesn't do that. But these the nerds and the geeks are starting to take over in a way. And it's scary, but it's also exciting at the same time.
Yeah, I think just here. End point, I was going to say the job description of a CMO is changing quite a bit, and who in the type of background and experience and, you know, data and analytics. I'm just thinking about, you know, my own business. I hired one of our senior marketing person that came from, you know, Disney and MySpace and very creative world. And that was great because finance is so boring and they needed a little spice. And that was great for us in kind of years 0 to 5, and now years 6 to 9, we, you know, parted ways with the creative guy and brought in a more data-driven marketer. I think you need both, obviously, but I think, you know, when I hear that question, I just think about the role of marketing is changing quite a bit, and the type of people you look for on top of that is very, very different. The hedge fund guys, the statisticians, the scientists that, you know, have been paid well by Wall Street and other folks, where, you know, there's actually pretty good dollars to be made in the ad business as well. And so you're getting that talent is on top of it.
There's a great article. I think it's the head of the CMO practice at Russell Reynolds. It's called The CMO of the Future. I think it's in Fortune or Forbes if you get a chance. Very enlightening article. You know, he speaks to that. He also did a personality study in a different publication about the CIO and the CMO and the CFO. So the colleagues of the CMO are these two other fellows or ladies. And it's really interesting that CMOs use powers of persuasion and emotion to get their way. And CFOs and CIOs use data and facts and analytics, and it's no surprise that they don't get along.
Right.
and there are, you've seen it, I think, in Ad Age, that the CMO office is now spending more money on IT than the CIO in some cases.
Yeah, I think another thing is what you're seeing with tech companies around here, and it's the blending of marketing, product, and data. So the growth marketing concept, where it's a reliance on data-driven insights, rapid testing, measurable testing, and quick product improvements. So another thing that's kind of branched out of that is the idea of the chief customer officer or centralized customer insights team. With all this data, it's not just enough to connect all of your marketing data. You have to look at how people are using your product, how they're interacting with customer service or sales. All of the different teams that interact with the customer are producing data from there. And a lot of companies aren't connecting that in a meaningful way, but some are. And they are centralizing that with an insights team. And it's created this need to understand the different data inputs, centralize, distill, and then redistribute to the people who need to utilize it. So I think that marketing is kind of pulled in more, or I guess some different areas from other orgs, and has the need to work more cross-functionally now because of all the areas that it can touch.
Great. So before we jump into audience questions, I wanted to ask one more question for the panelists. What is, for each of you, what is one non-obvious prediction you have about the future of marketing in 5 years?
I'll go with, because this is probably, I think, would be a non-obvious one, and comes, again, from my vertical, blockchain. For those that don't know, it's what Bitcoin is, you know, the cryptocurrency is based on. It's a ledger of transactions. What the hell does that have to do with marketing? You think about the ad exchanges, it's basically like the stock market. People are bidding and selling and buying, you know, banners. And I think similarly, the security and the data storage that the blockchain, which is being invested in by billions and billions of dollars by major financial institutions and world organizations, I think will come like the stock exchange came to the ad market. And I think in that time frame, and it's going to create, you know, different ways to manage, you know, fraud, data, security issues. It's going to data storage itself, I think, will change considerably with this. There's, you know, even in, I think it's a Danish ad network is taking IOs, insertion orders with Bitcoins that you can pay with. That's kind of at a smaller scale, but I when I think about non-obvious, that kind of rings to my mind.
I think that the line between, I guess, marketing and the personal assistance, the AI bot personal assistance, is going to become blurred. It's going to be a situation where it's a lot more predictive. It's a lot more anticipatory. Rather than being reactive and seeing what you've done in the past, kind of the context around what you're doing now, it's you're going to see with machine learning ads that don't necessarily seem like ads, something that's much more seamlessly integrated and useful into your everyday life. But on the back end, someone's probably paying for that, which, you know, I think could raise some interesting discussion. But at the same time, if it is creating value, if it is enhancing your experience, you know, it could be all right.
So our job as marketers is to always connect with the consumer. And that means we need to know what they're doing, and they're completely unpredictable. So what is the next trend and phase? Where are they going to spend their time? And if you've had a chance to wear the VR visors, and I mean, don't you just want to lose yourself in that world? It's a lot better sometimes than the world you're living in. And so if our teens and those teens grow up to be in their 20s, if they love this environment and that's where they spend their time, that means they're not looking at their phone. That means they're not watching television or looking at their laptop. That becomes the new medium. And you've got to connect with them. So 5 years might be long enough where that actually comes into real play. I think we need to watch AR, VR very carefully.
Great. We will jump into audience questions.
Yeah, now. We would like to remind our audience this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor to questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please keep it short and concise. You can come right up to the mic and ask the question if you like.
So YouTube's come under a lot of fire recently for connecting their advertisers to racist or otherwise repugnant content. Is this something they're going to be able to solve pretty readily, or is it going to be with us for a while?
As an agency, what we do on our end is we kind of have an agency-wide what we call blacklist of types of content, types of sites that we don't want any of our clients on. It's still kind of a whack-a-mole game where as new stuff pops up, it's tough to stay ahead of. So some of it is on the publisher to help us, but we have to be proactive as well to kind of protect our clients from that.
Yeah, I have full confidence that will be fixed. I don't know, but they probably have already fixed it.
Yeah.
It's easy to fix.
Well, I don't know if I totally agree. And I'm not talking about YouTube per se, but I think, you know, having your ads as a marketer being associated with questionable content, that's where I feel that question is coming from. And you can't control that content, you know, more often than not. So, yes, it's on the role of the publisher to make sure it's quality and the marketer and agency, but you can't control that. And I think there's only so much technology gets you towards managing where that placement happens. I think it will be better controlled for sure. But I still think there's some major holes when you talk about kind of marrying context and data together and how people are actually able to resolve for that.
Do the dynamics you discuss also apply the same way to emerging economies and those highly regulated countries such as China or India or Turkey?
Well, if you look at Southeast Asia, that's where a lot of the ad blocking is actually happening. That's one of the fastest growing ad blocking regions, but it's for a totally different reason. It has nothing to do with privacy. It's all about bandwidth. The ads that they're seeing on their phones, it's slowing down the experience. So people are using ad blocking for a totally different reason. I think when you talk about emerging markets, you have to realize that they aren't using the smartphones the way we are. They're working off a much slower data connection. So their experience in some countries could be what we were experiencing 5 years ago or with the original iPhone. There's, you know, dumb phones still there. It's very different experience. So I think all of those markets are going through kind of their own emerging trends.
Yeah, but I would add or say that they're mobile first countries in some ways. They didn't grow up the way we did. They're growing up faster in some ways because of it. In India, there's a whole new way of that they're enabling people to, you know, we got to type in a email and your password to get in your bank. They're moving to your fingerprint, right? So that as an example, I think they're going to be actually creating, we're going to be following a lot of what they are doing in some ways, maybe not in the next few years, but 5 to 10 years, just given where we started, even though they're kind of copycatting a lot of what we built here.
So with all this hyper-consolidation we're seeing in this ad space, do you see there becoming a supply problem with some of these marketplaces? And where do you see marketers that are wanting to become more efficient with their ad spend as it becomes more competitive on Google and Facebook? Where do you see them where would you advise them to start looking maybe over the next 5 years to spend or to start maybe finding their audience outside of Google and Facebook?
Do we have a supply problem?
I think
when everybody's an author and a publisher, there's a great deal of supply, but that's...
It's quality versus quantity. Obviously, there is a supply problem from a quantity point of view, but I don't think there really is from a quality standpoint. I mean, I think as long as you dig into where that either source of data is or the context quality of it, you won't have that media bleed of spending that I think was much more prevalent 10 years ago, let alone prior to the internet. We were just talking on stage here about how finitely you can pinpoint your audiences, which only is making your marketing more efficient. So yes, I think there is an abundance of supply out there, but I think you have to question the quality of your data and the context you're in, and in terms of where beyond Google and Facebook, it just goes back to what I said earlier. You got to dig into the context that your user is in, or where that data is coming from. I think just spending it programmatically without understanding where it's going is an issue from a supply point of view.
For a young / startup company first getting into digital marketing, what expertise would you recommend that they first develop an expertise in-house to get going?
On the creative side or on the...
On either. What would you say is like the most important for the company to develop like in-house as opposed to outsourcing?
A culture of data and testing. If you understand how to leverage your data, how to make sense of it and improve your business using it, I think that's most key. If you're not doing that, everything else will fall apart if it's not built on a foundation of, you know, data and analysis.
I'm personally a big fan of keeping the creative outside. I think you lose the edge and the willingness to challenge status quo when you're in-house. So I would hope that that stays the way it's been working for a long time. The media side, the data, the analytics, the measurement, I think that is something to take in-house and develop the expertise. It really depends on whether you're B2B or B2C. What is your product? What's the differentiation, the competition? What is your target market? Really understanding that whole consumer journey, I think, is important, and doing that in an analytical fashion so that you know when you buy media and you do advertising, even if it's an email newsletter, even if you're hosting an event, to really tie all that together and think from, as a young company, it's exciting because you have the ability to know when you start to do something, did it drive sales or not? After 20 years and you're spending $500 million, you lose track of what's working and what's not. You stick to it because you're scared to pull the plug on that, right? Because you've got offline stuff, online stuff, billboards, sports sponsorships, direct mail. And if you pull one, you know, like it's the signal that comes back is really weak. So you're actually in a great spot.
So my question actually kind of relates to that a little bit. What do you think in terms of, you know, buying technologies? There's so many out there right now. If you were a startup, like, what are the two pieces of technology or three pieces of technology that you would invest in for your business?
As a publisher, what kind of?
Well, just like in terms of just getting the right information, you're talking about needing to understand the data.
Yeah.
Is there like certain platforms that you would recommend to, you know, kind of synthesize that data?
Yeah. Well, you need a DMP, a data management platform. Some of that you could warehouse and build yourself. We used Xlate, which is part of Nielsen. There's BlueKai, which is part of Oracle. There's Crux, which I think is Salesforce now. So I think a DMP is an important piece of technology that I wouldn't build in-house. But then there's visualizing that data too. There's companies like Tableau or Looker or I think Domo, and I think beyond, and then hiring the right people to manage those systems. But so we've spent a lot of time in the last several years looking at which systems to use, about how do we manage our data. And we've gone with basically, in our case, Xlate and Domo, but there's a lot of great gold standards in those arenas.
I'd say you want to track the consumer journey, right? So what, in addition to that, you want to track how they interact with you on your site, on your mobile. Google has the tools. Facebook has the tools to do that. Google has its DMP, the Audience Center. Facebook has Atlas and all the information that's in there. I think they also, these people buy from the Xlates and the Oracles of the world to populate that information. But you want to track them from when you reached them through the ad server, when you know how much you paid for that reach, and then what did they do afterwards? Did they do nothing? Did they take an action towards your brand? Did they go investigate a competitor's product? You can actually look at latitude, longitude data and say, well, I showed them the ad about my category and actually sent them to my competitor's store. Through lat long data, you can actually get that. And did they ever come to your store? That could be very good to just understand that they're now in the market for your product and you want to heavy up on a custom tailored message since you know which competitor they visited. All of that is possible today. Are you asking from a smaller company perspective?
Yeah, just in general, because a lot of startups, you know, and just, you know, obviously there's so many platforms that you can invest in.
Yeah, I mean, being a go-to-market advisor for a number of younger companies, Google's almost always in the shop. Facebook is there. They tend, because people are using search, right, naturally, and they're doing Facebook because of the efficiencies and the accuracy. Those are two great places to start. And they come with the DMPs as well.
And now for our last question.
So I may work in a PR and marketing space in my day job, but when I leave the day job and I put on my media consumer hat, even I'm determined to avoid advertising and marketing like the plague. Whether it's using Netflix so I don't have to watch television commercials, whether it's having a landline, not giving out my phone number, I've not spoken to a telemarketer in years and years, or when I'm on the internet using every ad blocker imaginable. So in my mind, I don't want to be reached unless I want to be reached. And it's only when I'm looking for information that a marketer can get to me. So my question is, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but for someone like me, what's the future of reaching people who, to a large degree, but not 100% degree, don't want to be reached?
How are you going to find out about new products?
You know what? As soon as I asked that question, I had a feeling someone's going to try to bounce it back on me. But I think in my mind...
That's the answer, right? That actually is the answer.
I'm going to go like to Google or to Bing or maybe to some other cool, hip thing that somebody else recommended. But I am going to proactively search for it, yes.
Yeah, so people want to know what your intent is, what products you're looking for. So as soon as you're ready, you're in market. In your case, you're avoiding it as much as possible. But when you're in market, that's when you're going to get hit. But, you know, if you choose not to use things like Facebook and other platforms where you're willingly giving your data up, you know, it may not be as, you know, well targeted, but your search interests and other things that have always been a great indicator, you know, it will be that moment in time when someone will get to you.
We haven't talked about it, but advertising can be largely summed up into two categories. You're either entertaining people or you're educating, right? And so if we're educating you, you might be more interested. If we're entertaining you and doing a good job, you're interested. If you can combine the two, that's amazing. And that's why you see the rise of native and content. This is now becoming the new generation, or the generation wants a two-way conversation. In the 70s and 80s, it was very much a one-way broadcast. That worked for folks in that consuming media at that time. But now it's a two-way situation. That's why you have messenger bots. You may order food. You know, if you go to China, you order food over your phone through a bot. You talk to a virtual waitress or waiter who serves you your food. And that is actually marketing. You know, what do you want?
Please join me in thanking our speakers this evening. We also want to thank our listening audience, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.